Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. On today's show, we're making a list and checking it twice to learn more about toxic chemicals in holiday gifts.
There are 80,000 chemicals in commerce. We know something about toxicity, about 400 of them.
From cosmetics to iPods and children's lunchboxes, thousands of everyday consumer products have substances that can affect our health and the environment. Are they being adequately regulated? And what's our responsibility as consumers?
What I would like people to do is take a look at that electronic device and know that it doesn't belong in the garbage, that they have a responsibility, just like government, just like the manufacturers do, to protect the planet. And it's pretty easy to do.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. Welcome to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour, we're looking into your holiday shopping list.
I'm giving the love of my life an Apple iPod because I think it'll really enrich her life.
I would like to be given a laptop.
For my son, anything that's Thomas the Train, Choo-Choo related, it'll be a big hit.
Shoppers in San Francisco with some of the items on their shopping list, things they're hoping to give or maybe hoping to get. This hour on Health Dialogues, a different take on holiday presents. What kinds of unexpected things might they have, like chemicals, that could be dangerous to you, your family, or the environment? Items like jewelry with lead or perfumes, toys, and teething rings with phthalates, chemicals that are linked to birth defects and sexual development problems in boys. What are the state and federal governments doing to protect us from chemicals in consumer products? And is it enough? My first guest is Mike Wilson. He's a public health researcher with the Center for Occupational and Environmental Health at UC Berkeley. Mike Wilson, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Scott.
Let's go back a couple of years, 2006. You wrote a report on the need for a more comprehensive, proactive state toxics program. What did you find in your research that led you to that conclusion?
Well, the legislature was responding to the problem of what they were facing, which was essentially these chemical-by-chemical bans, if you will, looking at somewhere between 35 to 40 bills at the time they commissioned this report, and recognizing that each time they contemplated a ban on one substance, pulling that substance out of commercial use, they introduced the possibility of a new substance coming in for which the hazardous properties were unknown, or in fact, introducing a substance that may be more toxic. And so they commissioned the university to really take a more comprehensive approach and what they could do.
So at that point, what was the state doing?
Well, the state had a patchwork a management strategy for chemicals, looking primarily really at end-of-pipe kinds of strategies around hazardous waste, worker protection for toxic materials, Proposition 65 on labeling and so forth, but really I think what might be called a patchwork and really pretty antiquated approach.
And when we talk about chemicals in consumer products, so I mean things like, you know, pesticides come to mind. But what else? What are some of the more subtle things that are in products that consumers use every day or might that could be potentially harmful?
Well, I think if we sort of back up a little bit, every day in California, there are about 164 million pounds of chemicals sold in consumer products every day. And in about 100 different product categories. And you know, most people believe that when they see a product on the shelf at the hardware store, a chemical product, that has gone through some form of pre-market screening, if you will, for its safety to public health, to environment, to children, and so forth. And that is simply not the case.
And that's because why? Why are those things? I mean, anything new that comes into the market now, there's all kinds of rigorous testing, certainly pharmaceuticals, for example. How do we get to the point where those things are, you know, very common on supermarket shelves and elsewhere, and yet we don't really know what impact they have on us?
When we're looking at the the chemical industrial system, we look at pesticides, and that has its own regulatory framework. And there is pre-market testing and disclosure and so forth in that arena. Same on pharmaceuticals. And what are called industrial chemicals that are used in products and in processes. There are no pre-market screening requirements under the Toxic Substances Control Act or under the Consumer Protection Act in the U.S.
Now, that law that you referred to, the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, I think it's called, was passed, I guess, in 1976. And my understanding is that at that point, all of these chemicals that were currently in use were kind of grandfathered in. Is that a good way to describe it?
That's exactly what happened. In 1979, when it was implemented, there were 62,000 chemicals in commercial use at that time that were used in industrial processes and in products. Those were assumed to be safe until proven otherwise by US EPA. And those chemicals, 62,000 chemicals, constitute about 98% of what's in commercial use today.
And so we have no real data on any of those things, you're saying?
There's extraordinarily poor information on those substances. EPA, over the course of the last few decades, has managed to review about 1,200 of those for their risk to public health. But in 1994, they reported to the GAO that they were concerned over about 16,000 of them on the basis of their volume in commerce and their chemical structure.
What are some of the ones that are of most concern to you and your colleagues?
Well, we're particularly concerned about bioaccumulative and persistent substances.
What does that mean?
These are substances that once they are dispersed into the environment, in some cases they persist for hundreds of years. They are showing up in people's bodies, in blood and tissues and so forth. They're showing up in umbilical cord blood. We're concerned about substances that can affect the germline, if you will, so carcinogens, reproductive toxicants, substances that can induce birth defects. And then when you combine that with chemical properties that cause them to persist, that means that we are delivering those substances into the environment and into future generations.
And give us a couple of examples of what those substances are and where they're found commonly.
Well, you have pollutants so dioxins, for example, that you get out of combustion products. But chlorinated substances that are used in cleaning products, brominated flame retardants we've heard a lot about. There's a large array of substances that are actually in commercial use today, widely used, that are known to be bioaccumulative and persistent.
And how do they get into our system?
Well, we use them in products. People are exposed in workplaces. There are low levels atmospherically, if you think about environmental exposures. But they are... they're inhaled primarily. I guess that's the primary exposure pathway,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah. Now, there is some level of regulation at the federal level. The FDA, the EPA are two of the main agencies. How are those systems different in terms of the power they have, the process that they use to protect us?
Well, the main entity that deals with industrial chemicals is the EPA. They are responsible for implementing TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act. That covers 80,000 industrial chemicals that are in commercial use today. And when you look at five other major federal statutes, OSHA, Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, a number of others, in total, those cover about 1,100 industrial chemicals. So TSCA covers by far the vast majority of chemicals in commercial use. And EPA is responsible for administering that act. There are just these two fundamental flaws that have really prevented us from implementing TSCA in an effective way. I mean, it was intended as a way for us to identify hazardous chemicals that are entering commercial use and control the ones of greatest concern.
And the flaws being the loopholes?
Well, exactly. That in the last days of negotiating that statute, we gave away, I guess the Congress, if you will, the obligation of chemical producers to generate and disclose information on the toxic properties of chemicals that they had on the market and were intending to put on the market.
Now, this week, the state released recommendations on green chemistry, the Green Chemistry Initiative. I know you had input into that report. We're short on time, but if you could just tell us what are the principles of green chemistry and where might that initiative be taking us in California?
The Green Chemistry Initiative represents really California's being the first state in the U.S. to step forward really into these policy voids that we have from the federal government and take national leadership on chemicals policy. And the concept of green chemistry is really sort of two primary areas. One is the technical and scientific development of safer molecules that are produced with safer processes and zero waste.
Obviously, benign by design, I think.
Benign by design. And this is the direction where we need to go. And the second piece of it is the policy and legal drivers that will motivate the chemical industry, chemical producers, to invest substantially in that arena, which they really haven't done up till this point.
And so California, being the big bear in the market in the U.S. anyway, is going to have a big impact on the rest of the country.
I think it's going to be an enormous impact. It's also there's a paradigm shift happening here in a way where, as I said, the strategy has been in other states around the U.S. on really these sort of chemical by chemical approaches. And when you have 80,000 chemicals in commercial use, 42 billion pounds a day being produced or imported, that's not a sustainable pathway. So I think California is really providing some leadership here.
All right. Mike Wilson, public health researcher with the Center for Occupational and Environmental Health at UC Berkeley. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Up next, we'll take a closer look inside a typical teenage girl's purse, or at least at her lotions, lip gloss, and eyeliner, to see what chemicals are lurking in everyday body products. The Food and Drug Administration, as we heard, was created to protect Americans from dangers in consumer products, but lobbyists succeeded in leaving cosmetics explicitly out of the FDA's reach. Today, no one uses more personal body products than teenage girls. And a recent study from the nonprofit Environmental Working Group suggests makeup and other cosmetics could pose serious health risks to teens. From KPBS, Kenny Goldberg has more.
Aubrey Cragen doesn't mess around with her appearance. She's 15. Looking good is like totally major. So every day, she follows a strict routine.
When I wash my face in the morning, there's moisturizer and then there's also Skin Rever Upper that's supposed to be like more moisturizer.
Then Cragen gets to work on her makeup.
Mascara, top eyeliner and bottom eyeliner, and eyeshadow.
Next, Cragen has to make sure she smells awesome.
I use all sorts of different deodorant and perfume every day, lotion every day, depending on what perfume. I have to, like, coordinate them.
Like, enough already. But Cragen's not done yet. There are a couple of other things she can't do without.
Body butter. I don't know if that's different than lotion. And hand sanitizer.
It's like a drugstore in here.
It is not. They're necessary if I'm going to be a girl.
A report from the Environmental Working Group suggests Cragen might want to back off her routine a little bit. The EWG study examined blood and urine samples from 20 teenage girls throughout the country. Researchers were looking for traces of hormone-altering chemicals found in cosmetics and body care products. These chemicals come from the families called phthalates, triclosan, parabens, and musks. They're widely used as fragrances, preservatives, and antibacterial agents. Laboratory tests detected an average of 13 toxic chemicals in each girl. Rebecca Sutton is a senior scientist in EWG's Oakland office. Sutton concedes the levels of the chemicals found were low, but she says chemicals that affect hormones can be active at extremely low levels.
Now, we're concerned especially with teens because they're going through a period of accelerated development where their reproductive system is maturing. Also, things like their bone, blood, and immune system is maturing, and there are even changes to brain structure and function. All these changes are guided by hormones, so if we have an industrial chemical that's invading their bodies that could act like a hormone or could block a hormone, then even at a low level, we need to be concerned.
Sutton says the study was unable to find a link between the amounts of cosmetics used and the levels of hormone-altering chemicals in the body. Still, she believes increased exposure to these toxins puts teens at higher risk of serious health problems. So how do teenage girls choose safer cosmetics? Sutton says it's tough.
Consumers have very little information about their products or about the health and safety concerns that might be associated with ingredients.
Sutton says the problem is the cosmetics industry regulates itself. She says the Food and Drug Administration leaves the public unprotected.
The FDA does not require products or their ingredients to be tested for safety before they are sold. So as it stands, the current system basically requires that you need a PhD in chemistry in order to buy safe products.
Aubrey Cragen doesn't have her high school diploma yet. So what is she supposed to do? Go without makeup? Whatever.
Completely natural is a stretch. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but I'll try to limit my use. Just no use at all is not going to happen.
Health experts say teens could choose products that have fewer ingredients. And they suggest teens could probably do without things like lip gloss. But don't take away their body butter. That stuff is sick. For Health Dialogues, I'm Kenny Goldberg.
Body butter, indeed. The FDA has no control over cosmetics, but they and the EPA are supposed to be protecting us from other potential health and environmental risks. How good a job are they doing? We're going to put that question to a couple of journalists who cover that issue, including a familiar voice to us, our health reporter, Sarah Varney.
Hello.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Mark Shapiro, editorial director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's author of the book Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. Mark, good to have you here as well.
Good to be here.
Your book, Mark, explores the different approaches that the U.S. and the European Union have taken in the past few years over regulation of these kinds of products. Describe that divergence and how are we doing it differently?
All right. Well, Mike was just talking about.
Mike Wilson.
Mike Wilson was just talking about a few minutes ago. He was talking about all the chemicals that have been grandfathered into the market here in the United States, some 62,000 chemicals. So the European Union went and looked at those chemicals and determined and is beginning the process of saying, wait a minute, we've got thousands of chemicals now on the market that we've never assessed for their toxicity. And so they are beginning systematically to demand data from manufacturers that has never been demanded before in the United States. So that's one huge difference between Europe and the United States. And they've also begun systematically to look at the chemical content of numerous consumer products. So everything like your piece on cosmetics, for example. What you were talking about there was the lack of FDA authority over cosmetics. So the European Union is not accepting that any longer. And they're saying, hold on here. If there are carcinogenic substances that cause mutation in human genes or damage to the reproductive system, should not be in cosmetics. And so systematically, they're beginning to demand the removal of those substances.
So And in your book, as you pointed out in great detail, that the chemical industry fought tooth and nail against those kinds of regulations to no avail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The chemical industry was sending lobbyists on a regular basis to the Brussels, capital of the European Union.
Now, the changes that are happening there and some of the changes that we've been talking about here in California with products like phthalates and other ingredients that are potentially harmful to us. What impact did the changes here and the changes there have on the country as a whole in terms of how the industry is going to begin marketing perhaps different products for Europe? Are we going to be getting those products here?
Yes. Well, I think what's very interesting is to understand that American companies have never had to obey other countries' rules ever before. Never happened before. The rules that happened here in the United States were essentially the rules for the world. Now that's switched. The European Union is now a larger economy than the United States. Huge change. So when the European Union now begins imposing these new environmental laws on the chemicals that they allow their citizens to be exposed to, American companies have to decide. Do we want to hold on to this European market, huge market for American companies, or are we going to give it up? And so in many cases, in many different industries, number one, there are two things happening. Either some companies are actually adapting to European regulations, and we become the accidental beneficiaries of those regulations. Also, by the way, the EPA becomes totally irrelevant in that situation. Or they begin to establish a line of products that will meet the European standards and other products simply for Americans that would not meet that. And that's how we in America have become the sort of bottom end of a global double standard.
A dumping ground.
The dumping ground for products that you cannot sell in Europe.
Sarah Varney, you've done a lot of reporting on phthalates, and there's a new law about to take effect in California. Tell us what phthalates are and why the law has focused on six of these particular phthalates.
Phthalates are a particular type of additive that's usually added to polyvinyl chloride to make it really soft and flexible. And it's used it's used in many phthalates used in many, many things, but in this case, in toys and childcare products, essentially. And so in January of next year, phthalates, these six particular phthalates, which are of the most concern in terms of their health risks, will be banned in California. There's a federal law that will go into effect in February as well.
And so is the one here, is it duplicative? I mean, is it going to accomplish something different than the federal law?
There's a lot of discussions right now between the California Attorney General's office and federal officials in terms of whether or not the California law is, in a sense, preempted by the federal law. But what is definitely clear is that California did go a step further than the federal law to specifically say you cannot substitute a phthalate with something that's known to cause cancer or reproductive harm. And that part of the California law will definitely go into effect. And so that's what I've been really looking into is, okay, well, now these phthalates are being banned, and they've been banned in Europe since 1999. What has actually been used in their place? And it turns out nobody knows, really. There's a couple. Because they don't have to disclose. And so if I bought some phthalate-free toys for my son, and I wanted to find out, well, if they're not phthalates in them, what's in them? I can't find that out. I call the EPA. I call the California EPA. I call these sorts of I call the companies. They don't have to tell me. And it actually turns out that in Europe, although they have this very aggressive type of chemical regulation, they don't know either. And so there, it's a bit of a black box to a certain extent of what are the substitutes that are coming onto the market when we do these individual kind of chemical bans.
Now, the chemical industry, I'm sure, opposed the original version of that law here in California. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. They were in Sacramento vehemently opposing it.
And so that and other legislation recently signed by the governor is the result of a compromise, as things often are in politics. So what is your sense of the benefit that's going to come from these various protective laws like the phthalate ban in California? Is it something that's going to happen overnight, or is it going to be something that happens gradually over time?
Well, I think the main question, I think to answer your question, toys and teething rings, for instance, are not necessarily the primary way that children, for instance, get exposed to phthalates. It's a place to start, and it's why the European Union started with toys. But there are so many other routes of exposure, particularly for pregnant women. And so most of what we know about phthalates is what we know about, say, pregnant rats who are exposed to phthalates, or pregnant women who have been exposed to phthalates, and what does that do to their baby, their offspring, their baby boys. So I think while there may be some you'll minimize the exposure to phthalates when this ban goes into effect in January, it certainly won't really do much to stem the stream of exposure.
And San Francisco, Mark, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just would add to what Sarah said. I think the beginning is like toys, but there are so many other sources of exposure that basically can be addressed only with the kind of a whole systematic approach.
Well, and that's what Mike Wilson was talking about, is that, you know, this is an example of legislation that focused on a particular chemical. But you're saying, Mark, that it's less effective than doing it in a comprehensive way?
A comprehensive way in determining what are the routes of exposure for other carcinogens or endocrine disruptors like phthalates are. Where else do we get them? I mean, the phthalates are in automobile dashboards, for example, which little children obviously drive in. They don't drive, they drive in. So I think what we're missing here is a seriously systematic look at all the ways through which we are exposed to toxic chemicals.
And there's a, I think there's a broad understanding of that, clearly in California, where we have this Green Chemistry Initiative. And in fact, when the governor signed the phthalate ban, he sort of reluctantly did so, saying, I'll sign this one, but you know, I really want to see much more comprehensive kind of regulation. And in fact, just last year, there were several individual bans on bisphenol A and some others that actually, well, that one didn't actually pass out of the assembly, but the governor refused to sign specifically because he wanted a broader framework.
All right. We'll continue our conversation with Sarah Varney and Mark Shapiro after a short break. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
On the next Health Dialogues, giving kids under the age of 5 a healthy head start. How do things like breastfeeding, good nutrition, vaccinations, even reading to your kids help jumpstart little ones for a healthy life ahead? It's all about the earliest years on the January edition of Health Dialogues.
And we continue with Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and we're talking this hour about chemicals in some very common consumer products, maybe things on your holiday shopping list. And our guests at the moment, Sarah Varney from the California Report, our health reporter. Also here, Mark Shapiro. He is the author of Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. We were talking before the break about some steps that California is taking to hone in on phthalates and then more generally to create a framework for green chemistry. What are some of the loopholes in that, the shortcomings of what California seems to be edging toward? Mark Shapiro?
Well, that is very interesting because it's really, for example, what is green? What is green? I mean, it's a nice little color we like very much.
kind of a Rorschach test for chemists.
I think that's a good way to look at it. It's whatever you want it to be. We were talking earlier about this notion of benign substances. Is a substance ever going to be perfectly benign? I think what we're talking about here is substances that are less, you know, I mean, less malevolent, I think, is a much more reasonable place to aspire towards than perfectly benign, to be totally honest. We're talking about substances that are sometimes synthetic, other times are based on biological material, which I think is many chemists are going towards new kind of forms of biological material. But the notion that we're going to get something that's absolutely perfectly benign is, I'm not sure, is a reasonable assumption. However, that said, there is a whole array of protections that we could be putting on right now that would ensure we're not getting the most malevolent substances, which we are now on a routine basis. And I think that's the critical matter. So not to get too caught up in imagining what I think is not necessarily possible.
So don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
That's another way to say it, Scott.
Sarah, what are your thoughts about that, about some of the – I mean, obviously this is a step in a good direction. I think a lot of people would agree. But there are some – we shouldn't expect too much too soon in terms of protection for us in the products we buy.
I think this is going to take many, many years, and we'll hear later from Maureen Gorson from Cal EPA about how long this is going to take. But there, you know, I think you've mentioned this, that there are two bills that have currently been passed and were signed by the governor that essentially give very broad authority to California EPA to regulate chemicals, much broader than they have now. But and I think the people who authored those bills will be the first to admit that they're far from perfect, and there'll likely be some cleanup legislation in the next year or so. But those bills really don't necessarily authorize the state to require the companies provide the data. They are really just sort of broad, like the Green Chemistry Report, they are really broad frameworks that regulators will have to sort of figure out what are they going to do with this power.
Is that kind of like Prop 65 where there's really – or even less than that? Because Prop 65 is a required kind of a – you have to provide warnings to people if certain substances are present, but you can't do anything to regulate them.
Right. Well, essentially what could happen under this particular new authority is the California EPA could look at certain chemicals and decide that they're going to restrict them or do an outright ban, or they could say, you know, this maybe fits under Mark's definition of it's not as bad for us as we think, and there aren't really great alternatives. So if you're looking at, say, phthalates in medical tubing versus phthalates in toys, you may say, well, there aren't great alternatives necessarily for phthalates in medical tubing, which I think there are. But if you make that case, you might be able to say, well, for this particular exception, you know, we'll allow this chemical to go in because the benefit is greater than taking it away.
And kids would be probably more vulnerable, especially if they're teething on something or playing with something. And, you know, they're also in a different stage of development, perhaps.
Absolutely. So. And I think there's throughout the next couple years, as state regulators sort of march through this world, they're going to be talking a lot about vulnerable populations. So they're going to be looking at pregnant women and certainly infants and children. And how do you specifically stem exposure for those populations? While, you know, exposure to phthalates for somebody, a 65-year-old male, probably not really that big of a problem.
We haven't talked a lot about electronics, but you can be sure that we're selling a whole lot of iPods and cell phones and all kinds of gadgets this holiday season. Mark, what are some of the concerns out there in terms of we're going to be talking more about disposal of electronic goods, but what are your thoughts about some of the potential hazards there for consumers?
Well, the hazards in electronics are interesting because inside each of those neat little devices that we each have, and iPods and computers and printers and et cetera, are small amounts of metals and chemicals that are used to essentially make the electronics work. And we're talking about chromium, cadmium, even mercury, lead, polybrominated flame retardants. And there's great concern. Not that when you're using it, but when you discard it and they end up in those very big heaps, those scrap heaps and the trash dumps, what happens when 10,000 computer monitors begin to leak? And they leak into the water, into the air of the substances that are inside. And so what I looked at in my book was essentially how the European Union has begun to demand that the six most toxic substances inside those machines be removed. And they did that also by requiring that the manufacturers be responsible for the disposal. Doesn't exist here in America. But in Europe, you go to any European electronics store, they have a take-back station where you're there. And so the company is responsible for disposing. The last thing I would say, just to pick up on what you were talking about earlier very quickly, the assumption in America is that a chemical is innocent until proven guilty. And we have to start beginning to change that approach from basically demonstrate the innocence of a chemical.
All right. Maybe some things to learn from Europe. All right. Mark Shapiro and Sarah Varney, thank you both very much. Coming up, we're going to be talking with one of California's top regulators about what the state is doing to usher in a new era of consumer protection. And we'll hear reaction to that from the American Chemistry Council. You're listening to Health Dialogues. You're listening to Health Dialogues. In this hour, we're examining the regulation of chemicals in thousands of everyday consumer products, from shower curtains to cell phones, lipstick to children's toys and lunchboxes. And by the way, if you'd like to participate in an online discussion about regulating the use of chemicals in consumer products, just go to our website, healthdialogues.org, and look for the box that says Join the Dialogue. Again, that's healthdialogues.org. Just click on Join the Dialogue. You'll also, in our last segment, we were talking about phthalate regulation. You'll find a timeline of phthalate regulation and testing data on toys and an interactive graphic along with a series of stories created by us and NPR. You can find it again at healthdialogues.org. Well, here in California, the agency charged with protecting the public health and the environment from toxic chemicals is the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Its director, Maureen Gorson, joins us now from Sacramento. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Also with us from the American Chemistry Council, Tim Shestick. He's the ACC's Director of State Affairs and Grassroots in Sacramento. Good to have you as well.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Let me begin with you, if I can, Maureen Gorson. The governor signed a couple of bills to broaden regulation of chemicals that are linked to cancer and other health problems here in California. How is that going to be a departure from what the state has been doing up to now?
Well, what we've been doing up to now, really for the past 30 years at CalEPA, 5,000 people, is when we are making a product in California, and that product, the manufacturer of that product has a byproduct, whether it's an emission into air or discharge into water, or it creates a waste that needs long-term care and stewardship so that doesn't impact the environment or public health. We've been implementing the laws that basically make sure that those byproducts, emissions, waste, and discharges, don't impact the environment and public health.
But the laws that the governor signed, SB 509, AB 1879, what are those new laws going to allow your department to do that you couldn't do before?
Right. Well, for the first time, we're going to be able to ask for information about ingredients in products, the toxicity of those ingredients. We're going to be able to require manufacturers to do alternatives analysis on what were the other less toxic or safer or healthier ingredients that they could have put in those products. After we get that information and require that analysis, we have authority to take regulatory action, which could include bans, phase-outs, restrictions, R&D requirements, extended producer responsibility.
And now, Tim Chestek, your industry, the chemical industry, has a vested interest in the way these laws are written and implemented. What concerns do you have, if any, about what Maureen Gorson just described about what's going to be happening here in California?
Well, I'm not sure I would characterize us in being in a position of concern at this point. I would say that not only from our industry's perspective, but I think a variety of our customer groups, other trade associations, and other industries were somewhat welcoming this kind of new initiative, if you will, because we've been experiencing, you know, historically these complex scientific discussions about chemical toxicity, chemical uses in products, hazard risk assessments, and what have you, being conducted really unfortunately, been conducted in a highly politicized environment in the legislature. And so I think from the industry's perspective, we're welcoming this opportunity to inject expertise, scientific expertise, in a more transparent and thoughtful process with the department and through this Green Chemistry Initiative to come to more sound scientific-based decisions than what we've been experiencing over the course of the last few years.
One of the concerns your industry has in Europe and in legislation that's made its way through Congress is this idea of disclosing specific ingredients. How are you going to get around that, or maybe you're not? Do you have to disclose these things?
Well, I think one of the concerns that I did not necessarily know has been resolved yet is how you may protect some of this confidential business information that may be a part of some of this ingredient disclosure data that would be become publicly available. And I think that discussion is going to be ongoing. But there are efforts underway, and as part of DTSC's initiative here is to make publicly available more information about chemicals, toxicity of chemicals, health effects data. A lot of that information has been gathered and is being gathered in a variety of different venues, federal, international. Canadians are developing some programs and data. So I think one of the cornerstones of DTSC's efforts here is to try to leverage that information, ensuring that all of the publicly available data is made available in a most efficient manner. And I think that's going to be an important point of this process going forward.
So your industry won't be fighting to protect the release of certain things?
Well, I mean, health effects data is something that we don't believe should be under any sort of kind of confidential business information. I think one of the concerns that some of the consumer product companies have is they hold dearly some of the formulations for some of their products, and an outright overall disclosure of every particular ingredient, I think, has caused some concern for them. And that discussion, I think, is going to be ongoing over the next few months of how to ensure that data is made available under the statute, but at the same time ensuring that data that is confidential as it relates to that individual company or product is somehow protected.
Maureen Gorson, there was a lot of, in the end, a lot of consensus about some of these recent consumer protection laws and the Green Chemistry Initiative. But the Ford Motor Company was one of those who opposed the Green Chemistry Initiative, I believe. And what their argument was that all these regulations are going to lead to higher costs for consumers with very little or no benefits. What's your take on that?
Well, I think what we're really looking at is these costs. If your product has a toxic ingredient that's going to harm the environment or harm public health, you may not be paying for those costs now, but you're going to pay them later.
What do you mean?
Well, for instance, I mean, if you make a product and it has a toxic ingredient and therefore it needs to be managed in a special way, that's expensive, right? Long-term stewardship of wastes is expensive. We require massive financial assurances for that, and we go after people for the cost of the state to manage that waste. If that product is affecting public health later on, you may suffer product liability lawsuits or toxic tort lawsuits, or if your product is going to harm the environment or require the state to manage it so it doesn't harm the environment, you're eventually going to pay those costs. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So if there is an alternative that's safer and you can move to it now and you can design your product to be benign by design, that is better for you.
Well, and in that regard, your agency released its Green Chemistry Report this week, 6 policy recommendations. What are the goals of those initiatives?
Well, the goal is very big. It is to change the paradigm with which we protect the environment from a cradle to grave, where we're looking at the emissions, waste, and discharges from an industrial production system that creates byproducts that are harmful, to an environmental regulatory system which focuses on the design of the products we consume and gives us 3 things: capacity, the capacity in our businesses and our workforce to invent safer materials, in information so that those people can know what the difference is between the ingredients and products that they're choosing along the supply chain as well as for consumers, and then tools to quickly assess what is safer.
Is this essentially bringing California closer in line with what we talked about earlier that's happening in the European Union with regard to standards for chemicals?
I think it goes beyond what Europe's doing. What Europe is doing is collecting information on toxicity of chemicals. And that's great. That we will use that information to increase our capacity to understand what's safer. But what we're doing is going beyond that, saying how we want businesses and consumers to use that information to quickly accelerate to substitutes which are safer.
And give us a sense of a timeline. I mean, this is very complicated. Designs of products can take years and years, even decades, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when will consumers actually begin to reap some of the benefits of this?
I think in the next few years. We are planning on coming out with a set of regs within the next year that would be a rudimentary alternatives analysis. We're looking at the alternatives analysis as a decision-making tool that will become better and better and more refined over time. And the analogy I like to use is like the search algorithms that Google uses. If you look at 14 years ago when the Internet was new and we used search algorithms, they were pretty good. But, of course, the ones we use now are much better. And in order to do life cycle environmental footprint comparative analysis of one product versus another, including all its ingredients, you're going to have huge mathematical equations comparing lots and lots of variables. So that tool will get better over time. But we anticipate having a tool like that in place in regs within the next year, and so requiring different product manufacturers and product sellers to put their products through this tool to understand, is there a concern about this product? Is there some safer way to make this product? We anticipate in the next few years.
All right. That's Maureen Gorson, director of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. That's part of Cal EPA. Thanks to you, and thanks also to Tim Shestick. He's director of state affairs for the American Chemistry Council in Sacramento. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. We've heard a lot this hour about chemicals and the things we buy and how they can harm us when we use them. But the potential hazard doesn't end once we throw some consumer products out. In fact, in the case of electronic gadgets like cell phones and iPods, disposal is where the problem begins, if so-called e-waste isn't handled properly. In the past 4 years, 540 million pounds of old TVs and computers alone were recycled in California. Many of them end up in places like this, the San Francisco dump. It sprawls over 40 acres in the southeast section of the city, not far from Candlestick Park. The first thing you notice as you drive up is the birds, hundreds of screaming seagulls scavenging amidst the piles of trash. We toured the dump with environmental manager Brad Darda to see what happens to e-waste once San Franciscans are done with it.
We're standing at the San Francisco Solid Waste Transfer and Recycling Center behind the office where we stage the e-waste for loading onto the truck to be recycled.
Televisions, computers, and other assorted e-waste are brought here, sorted, and then shipped to a recycling company across the bay, which disposes of all of it in accordance with state law. A recent report on 60 Minutes showed a licensed recycler hired by the city of Denver that was illegally sending e-waste to China, where it was piling up and destroying the environment in Hong Kong. I asked Debbie Raffel, chief of toxics reduction at San Francisco's Department of the Environment, how the city ensures that that doesn't happen after e-waste leaves here.
We see their dismantling. We can physically go to their shop and see that they don't take a whole monitor and stick it on a rail car somewhere. We can see that they're taking the glass out and putting it in one place, taking the plastic and putting it in another place, taking the metal, and then they can show us a paper trail of where that metal went to and where that glass went to.
If e-waste ends up in a landfill or out in a field somewhere it doesn't belong, the problem is this. The heavy metals like lead, copper, and mercury in cell phones, TVs, iPods, and so on, those metals can mix with rain and end up leaching into water supplies. If consumers don't bring their e-waste to the dump for proper disposal, folks here keep an eye out for it in the stream of waste that ends up here. And it is an extensive stream.
Fax machines, telephones, answering machines, radios, stereo equipment, tape players and recorders, phonographs, strangely.
Passed 3 years ago, California's E-Waste Recycling Act, SB 20, created a complicated system for funding the collection and recycling of old electronics. The first step occurs when you buy something. You pay the seller, Apple, Best Buy, whoever, a small fee from $2 to $10, and that's used to offset the cost of properly disposing of it when you're done. After they leave the San Francisco dump, old TVs and computers with their lead-filled cathode ray tubes are taken apart and recycled. Other things, like stereos and toasters, get ground up into small pieces that are sorted by density and recycled as well. Looking out at the sea of waste here at the dump, Debbie Raffel says she'd like to see companies design these products in ways that make them easier to dismantle and recycle.
The other thing that we would really like to see businesses do is ask the question, is it necessary to make this product with a toxic chemical? Is there a safer way to achieve the same endpoint without needing to put a heavy metal into it that's going to poison fish, poison the planet, and never go away because it never degrades?
Until companies start making greener electronics, it's up to us to make sure they end up in the right place. In other words, not in a landfill. I asked Debbie Raffel what she would like people to think about this holiday season as they're buying that new TV, stereo, or coffee maker.
I would like people to think about when they make a purchase, is it something that can grow with the child and change with the child or with the spouse or their friend? You know, is it something that can be added to and upgraded, or is it something that by its very nature is going to become obsolete by next Christmas? Because not generating the waste to begin with is the best answer.
And for more information on how to recycle your e-waste, go to erecycle.org. That's e-recycle.org. There's all kinds of information on recycling e-waste in your area. And to see photos of our trip to the dump, they're at our website, healthdialogues.org. A All these green chemistry initiatives in California raise the question, what would consumer products, a toy for instance, what would it look like in this new world of green chemistry? Reporter Sarah Varney found one company taking a novel approach to design and manufacturing that might make its products some of the greenest toys around.
San Francisco entrepreneur Robert Von Gaben is standing over an enormous box of iridescent plastic bits at a toy factory in San Leandro.
These little white pellets that we have here, this is literally reprocessed milk jugs.
When Von Gaben founded his toy company called Green Toys, he decided to start with a question. What's the safest plastic you could use to make a toy?
These are the milk jugs that consumers in California throw in their recycle bin. And they're literally ground up, cleaned, melted down, and created into these little beads that are the raw materials that we use.
Von Gaben sells pint-sized pink teapots, green sand buckets, and sturdy orange trowels. They're all made from recycled HDPE, or high-density polyethylene. HDPE is one of the safest plastics because it doesn't contain chemical additives that can leach out into children's mouths and pose health risks. Because of growing concerns over lead, phthalates, and bisphenol A, Von Gaben says parents are beginning to take a closer look at their kids' toy chests.
Parents are treating toys like food. They want to know what's in the toy. What's happening in toys is what happened 10, 15 years ago with food.
But unlike food, toy manufacturers are under no obligation to tell parents what's in their products. And most toy companies say the ingredients in everything from teething rings to teapots are trade secrets.
We were one of the first companies to ever say, here's what our toys are made out of. We tell you what it's made from, where we get the material. If someone wants to know where we manufacture it, we tell where we manufacture it. As a brand builder, the way we build trust is full disclosure.
What we're looking at here is this is a big old box of small blue teacups, and they're very hot because they just came out of the mold. And a teacup is a perfect example of what works for this material because you can drink out of it. It meets FDA specs for food contact. It's very rigid, so it's not going to shatter or break. And when you give this to a little kid, you can say, this is why recycling is important, because we don't have to make something new. It becomes this.
Von Gaben hopes his toys help kids learn what they buy matters to their health and to the environment. And perhaps gives them a reason for recycling, since their milk jugs can come back to them as something fun. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
And that's all the time we have today. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us this hour. If you missed any part of our discussion or want to listen to past shows, just go to our website, healthdialogues.org. You can also add your comments to our online discussion and subscribe to our podcast. Again, just go to healthdialogues.org. On the next Health Dialogues, we'll use the first month of the year to explore the first years of life and how to give infants, toddlers, and little kids their best chance for a long and healthy life. Join us for the January edition of Health Dialogues. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. The engineer is Seal Muller, with help from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Eric Gillespie is our outreach manager. Gabriel Cohn is the online editor. Our social media web producer is Nick Vidinsky. The senior producer is Polly Stryker. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org, and the members of KQED Public Radio.